Thank you for coming to our panel, The Habits of Being Mormon, Women's Inherited Material Culture. And I just want to give you a little bit of background about how it came to be and just share some remarks, and then we'll be hearing from the people who participated in the exhibit, some of them. So, the idea for an exhibit on Mormon women's material culture, of course prompted by this year's Sunstone theme, came to me in a flash in the shower one day. I'd recently read my cousin Sarah Carlson's craft and bakery blog. On it, she featured a recipe for caramel cake made by our grandmother, Madeline Jane Snowball Pinborough. Madeline used to make the cake for Sarah's father, Alan, and Sarah wanted to make it for him for his birthday. Madeline's recipes had recently come into Sarah's possession from my family's kitchen cupboard, and she was eager to try them out. Sarah wrote, "It is so thrilling to think that I could be cooking some of the same meals for my family today that Madeline made 50 years ago." Through her recipes, Madeline, although 23 years gone, and her memory were enabled to be a vital, living part of Sarah's life. In a way, Sarah was reenacting the life of her grandmother. Sarah's and Madeline's lives, separated by time and space, became more entwined through the simple act of baking, the same caramel cake with the same ingredients. Past and present experience merged into the ongoing history of the caramel cake and her family. Whereas their shared blood and interactions had always served as a point of meaning for Sarah, now the caramel cake became an opportunity for Sarah to learn about Madeline's life a bit by learning to make the cake she made. I suppose that other women have had similar experiences with their ancestresses, that their ancestresses live through the objects they leave, and that they continue to teach their descendants how to live. I wanted to give women an opportunity to tell their stories that may only be told among family members or that may never be fully verbalized at all, only living in the hearts of the men and women who experience them. Exponent 2 editors Emily and Amy quickly offered their support for the project. We put out a call on the blog, and women responded with objects and essays detailing how these objects serve as sometimes daily reminders of what it means to live like our foremothers. As I read the essays and typeset them, along with the photos, I was brought to tears by the sheer beauty of their humanness. Through the jewelry, china, textiles, furniture, and written words that these women have inherited, they've also inherited ideas about faith and religiosity, womanhood, familial service and continuity, and the nature of life. As these objects provide clues to who these ancestresses were, it's a hard word to say, they also prompt questions and signify unfolding mystery, as Chris Ann Hastings notes in her essay. Who exactly were these women? What did they do on a daily basis? Anne Whitaker wonders whether her great-grandmother Annie Thane, a midwife, participated in anointing women for pain at childbirth when it was an accepted ritual. How did these women respond to tragic and joyful events? Emily Clyde Curtis wonders. How did those events shape them into women of character who have been strong links in the lines of women that will extend into the future? These objects have gained new life through their new owners. Megan Rains uses her grandmother's Grecian ring with a picture of Athena engraved on it as a symbol of her empowerment. She writes, "I wore her ring when I met and fell in love with my husband. I wore it for my temple wedding and used the ring as a token of my power in a place that feels profoundly disempowering. I've worn my grandmother's ring for graduate and job interviews, and during the births of each of my three children, the ring has been on my finger, a tangible anchor to hold as I have walked through the valley of the shadow of death." I mean, beautiful stuff here. And so some of the women who participated in the exhibit are going to be speaking to us, Emily, Chris Ann, and Kay, and they're going to share their ancestresses' stories more in depth and explore some of their habits of being, the way they live their lives, that have had an influence on them. Chris will be addressing how Mormon women created and interacted with sacred objects, and Anita and Chris Ann will be particularly addressing how technology helps them to retain their foremothers in remembrance. We'll hear from them, followed by a discussion of their remarks in the exhibit afterwards. So, kindly give it up for Emily.
When Elizabeth came to us every year, or Exponent, I'm getting Sensor and Exponent mixed up a lot today because we love them. Every year we want Exponent to be represented somehow at Sunstone. And this year Amy and I were thinking about how to do it, and Elizabeth came up with this brilliant idea, which I think fits in so well with Exponent's mission, where these objects, but it's done in a different way. As Exponent tries to share women's experiences and their personal history through primarily words, through our personal essays, through poetry that we publish, Elizabeth has gone ahead this great idea to use artifacts. And as she has done this, it's really helped me to think about the artifacts in my own home. So I have written up, and you can go read it, and I won't bore you with everything I know about the dining room set of my great-grandmother's. I have shared there. But in doing that, I've been looking around and finding other ways that my ancestors have influenced my life in very subtle ways that I wouldn't even know. And one way was this morning, this is a jar of jam. I've never made jam until about 3 weeks ago, but people assured me it was easy. And I have a garden, and we have these strawberries that have been growing there. And so I picked them and made this jam. I was so proud of myself, and I gave some to my grandmother this morning to thank her for letting me stay with her. And I said, now these are Arizona strawberries. If your strawberries grow in Arizona, they're not going to be very sweet, so they're really only good in jam. And she said, oh, this is wonderful. And she said, my grandmother used to make jam. This is going to make me cry. And she said she would just go out and harvest, you know, about a cup of berries a week, because she didn't have a big plot, I don't have a big plot, and she'd put them in the freezer or in the icebox until she had enough to make jam. And I thought, that's exactly what I've done. And I never... It makes me think of what comes through in our DNA, that I had the same idea that my great-great-grandmother did, and I didn't know it. So I wanted to give this to Elizabeth to thank her for her work today. Because it is such a lovely project. I also wanted to talk about exponents as an artifact that we pass down. The stories that women write about in our magazine explicitly express their personal history, and sometimes it's explicitly express the histories of their ancestresses, and often implicitly, and sometimes explicitly too. We have had a personal essay winner in the early 2000s. Write about her grandmother's lemon curd recipe. She shared the recipe with us in that issue. And what it has meant to her, the comfort and meditative time that she derives as she makes it and enjoys eating it. And more recently, we have had Kylie Nielsen Turley's essay in our Mother's Day issue explaining how she comes from a long line of mean moms, and as a mean mom, I could very much identify with this, who have helped their children better themselves through this no-nonsense parenting style that doesn't quite fit with the traditional soft-spoken, ever-patient, saintly mothers we hear about over the pulpit each Mother's Day. As Amy and I have become editors of the paper, we have also worked to showcase women's work beyond the written word to soliciting a variety of artwork from Mormon women. I've noticed that we can learn something of these women artists, their thoughts and their focuses in their lives through the tangible artwork that they produce. We can learn just really interesting things about ourselves and sometimes about them. I brought this fresco that was done by Tessa Lindsay, a reinterpreted work of that famous Eliza Arsenault portrait. We have, in this most recent issue, we have Ginny Ho's artist installation from a very more modern art rather than the traditional paint or sculpture. She has done this interactive modern art exhibit that we have covered. And we have, you know, the Valentine's Day cookies that a woman has made and photographed in our winter 2010 issue. We also want to emphasize the spiritual heritage and sisterhood that we as Mormon women share. And we have created the exponent generations in each issue, which takes a piece from the woman's exponent that began in the 19th century and went to the 20th century, exponent 2 and the exponent blog. And each we pick a piece from each one of these that all share a common thread. And it's amazing in this 150-year history that you can see these issues that we're still struggling with. And so we can feel more tied to both the Mormon sisterhood we share as well as our biological sisterhood that we share through these artifacts. beyond the work that we show in the magazine, Amy and I see the collections of the issues of the paper as objects that we, very much as the objects that we read about in this Habits of Being display. Over the years, I've heard about people inheriting Exponent 2 collections from both their spiritual sisters and their ancestresses. Okay, a little better. And I've begun to wonder how many of us were introduced to Mormon feminism by the copies of Exponent 2 in our grandmother's or our mother's or our aunt's garage or attic or office. And what do we learn about those family members or those Mormon sisters when they choose to save their Exponent 2s and what it means to them and how it shapes us when we receive those. In a time when more and more publications exist solely online, and as Exponent 2 continues, as so many alternative Mormon publications do, to worry about financial considerations, we have made the decision to begin again having Exponent 2 in hard copy form. For a few years, we just did it online. Because like the rings, the china, the blankets, the Exponent 2 copies tell a story, both in that they are saved artifacts and quite literally. And I'm so pleased to hear more about the artifacts I've already read about today. Thank you.
Well, I was delighted to have a chance to participate because I've almost always been very interested in family history and in the things that my grandmothers left behind. And so I couldn't resist talking about a grandmother on both sides, each side. Can you see that okay? I need to turn lights off, do you think? I've got some pictures, so it might be nice to have some lights down. What do you think? I've got two grandmothers that I'm talking, obviously I have two grandmothers. I'm going to talk briefly about both each of them. One of them had a pioneer heritage. Her parents had come across the plains. And the other one was an immigrant in 1903 who was converted in Sweden and came to the States. Now this, I have a much nicer picture of the one on the left. No nice pictures were taken of my other grandma Hellstrom in her older years, but every picture we have shows her with her flowers, and that's what's significant about her. Now the one on the left, as I said, has the pioneer heritage, of which she was very proud. This was when she was young and but when I met her, she looked like she did on the left because my parents were each the seventh of their children and were born when their mothers were in their 40s. So Grandma Helston was already 70. I mean, Grandma Stevens was 70 when I was born, so I never saw her looking different than the typical 50s grandma. Same with Grandma Helston. She was 64 when I was born, and so I only knew old grandmas. But I saw each of them. I saw Grandma Stevens working on her crochet as well as doing her housework and staying very active into her 80s. She lived into her 90s. And Grandma Helston, I always saw her working with her flowers. Now, my pioneer grandma was very proud of her heritage. She was the granddaughter of the first bishop of the church, Edward Partridge. That was a point of great pride. Her father was a polygamist. Her mother, pictured in the middle there on the left of my grandma, was the second wife. And my grandma was very proud of that, but it wasn't until adults that I began to think, really, what was that like for her living in a polygamist family, because you see her father is not in this picture. You rarely see a picture of a second family with the father in the picture. Maybe they were being careful about evidence for the feds, I don't know. But in this case, the first wife was the one that went with him when he was mission president in the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii. The first wife is the one he lived with till his death after the manifesto. It was after the manifesto. And Elizabeth, my grandma's mother, was stuck away in a house. He built a house for her in Fillmore, left her there, and references in his extensive journals to seeing her occasionally, not a lot of references, but very often he was doing his business in Fillmore with his farms and so on at the same time, so it's almost as though they were an afterthought. Yet my grandma was very proud of the fact that she was a member of that family, so the arrow's pointing to my grandma. Her hard life did not stop when she married. That little diagram shows the 10 different places that she and her husband homesteaded in the first 30 years of their marriage, starting in central Utah, going up to Canada, coming back down through Idaho when Canada didn't prove to be very profitable. So her life was a real struggle, always going to a new place, setting up a, building a log cabin, et cetera, and just trying to survive and never doing very well at surviving. And they finally settled in Salt Lake in about 1927 and gave up on farming, and he tried to make a living as a salesman and other things, but it was a, her whole life was a struggle. And yet she had the energy to keep on struggling till through age 90. In 1950, she was pictured in the Relief Society magazine, surrounded by some of her handiwork. And I doubt it was all of it, but it was certainly a lot of it, isn't it? everything from afghans, crocheted afghans. Well, most of it's crochet work. There's some embroidery work, the embroidery around pillow slips and so on. There was enough of it that many members of the family got to inherit it. She had seven children who all had five children, so there's lots of descendants, but there was enough of it that many of us got to inherit at least one thing. I received that one, which you can see where it is in her picture. And when my daughter named her daughter Clara after her great-grandmother, I gave that to my daughter to pass on to Clara. So that's my little granddaughter Clara there with that piece of crocheted doily. So she did leave on a material heritage for her descendants to enjoy. But most of all, what she wanted to leave was her testimony of the church and the hope that the struggles that she, her ancestors, her father and grandfather, and she and her husband had gone through were not in vain, that we would all appreciate the church. Here's some of her pieces in detail. These don't belong to me. I just borrowed them to show a few pictures. Very fine. I was just, when I sat and looked at it, it's very fine work. I just can't, this big, huge tablecloth, the detail in the left-hand corner, I couldn't find any errors in it. It's perfect, and it's very fine crochet yarn and so on. So she managed to keep her eyesight into her old age, too, to keep doing this kind of thing. Now, my other grandma was, as I said, converted in Sweden. That's a picture of her on her wedding day on Midsummer Day in 1900, surrounded by her brothers and sisters and parents. So she came from a very large family, of which she was the oldest. So like a typical Mormon family, even today sometimes, her mother had babies on her knee as well as getting her daughter married. And most of the children eventually came to the U.S. Not all of them stayed. A few of them went back and lived in Sweden. About half of them probably converted to the Mormon church. Not all of them stayed in the Mormon church either. But once she left Sweden in 1903, 3 years after this picture, she never saw her parents again. They never came to the U.S., and she was never able to go back, so she made that big sacrifice to come to America for the church. And, of course, being in America as immigrants, that was a struggle, too. Her husband had a pretty fairly successful business as a baker in Sweden. As far as we know, it was successful. He had several assistants in his shop. And yet, when he decided, he was the one that first met the church and got converted and came over in 1902, and then she followed a year later in 1903, so they gave it all up to come to the United States, where he was a baker's assistant for a while at a place called Applequist in Salt Lake, and eventually had his own little shop. But he acquired what was called baker's consumption, lung difficulties, and by 1919 he was dead, and she was on her own to support her family, the youngest of which was my father, who was about 3 years old at the time. So she had to make a living in the United States, which she started a little grocery store in the front room of her house. That was kind of typical even when I was growing up, to have little corner neighborhood stores where somebody had a little shop in a room in their house. And that was successful enough that she was able to raise their children, who were not already adults by the time her father died, which was more than half of them. And my father actually took over that business when he was grown and freed her up to retire. Somehow she... In those early years, somewhere in the early 20s, she bought a car on credit, which the person she bought it from was reported to have said, "I know I don't worry a bit about giving her this car on credit. I know that if anything, she'll pay for it early rather than be late." So she evidently had a good reputation as a businesswoman. And she had enough saved up that she could build herself a retirement home where she had a huge yard and had a garden. So she's in a garden here with her husband, the last known photo of him. He died 4 years after that. And where she lived where she had the little grocery store was in a, even then, kind of industrial section in west on the west side of Salt Lake, about 13 South and 200 West. But she grew this marvelous garden in among all the brick stacks of the neighboring industrial things. So she was always spending as much time as she could in the garden, even though she was having to support her family as well. There's another one of her with her flowers. And so, as I said, most of the photos we have of her show her with her flowers. Now, is this a material heritage? Well, none of us are quite the gardener she was, but my parents took rhizomes from her irises and probably other plants as well, other offshoot in the 50s when they had their garden. And that was the garden of my parents, from in which they used rhizomes from her irises. And that's my brother Rick at a young age at 1979. And here's my brother Rick today in his garden where he has transplants of those same rhizomes. So we have the descendants of her flowers in gardens of my siblings that live in Utah and Idaho, Utah and Colorado. We can't grow them in Arizona, but I enjoy them whenever I come home. So that's one thing she left to us. Another thing that and here's a picture of her. She was such a gardener that we have at least a dozen clippings of her from the newspapers of talking about the wonderful things she was doing. In that retirement home she built, she had a conservatory where she grew up with lots of exotic plants that were quite rare then, that not everybody had access to. And the other thing that she left was she died in 1953 when I was 10, but I do remember the Christmas Eve parties at her house prior to that. And one of the treats that she had was a little Swedish tart. And my dad inherited her tartlet pans, which would have dated from probably when she was married, 1900, little tin tartlet pans. And my mother always made this recipe for us. And then all of us, myself and my siblings, we loved that so much, we went out and bought our own little aluminum tins that you can get now and carried on that tradition. And I have a photograph of my daughter in 1977. We combined that with the Swedish tradition of Santa Lucia, which is normally done on December 13th, but we made it part of our Christmas Eve. We served that and had the oldest daughter dressed up as Santa Lucia with candles on her head, but my brother went on a mission to Sweden about that time, and he brought us back a battery-operated Santa Lucia. We did one occasion go to a ceremony where a girl was wearing one with actual candles, and she had to have a wet cloth over her hair just in case something dripped on it. So no point in trying that on a regular basis. So we were happy to get the battery-operated one, which we used throughout their childhood. So we do respect and honor and love the traditions that that came down to us through our ancestors, and in this case, particularly the maternal ancestors. It is interesting that what we have in material terms is from our maternal ancestors, not the men. So I was going to try and wrong thing. I was going to close that. Using shortcut keys, but I hit the wrong ones, so I'm so lousy with the mouse track that I was going to do that. That's not the mouse there. Okay, so I'll do that to make sure. Let's see. Okay.
Really interesting that I've actually been thinking about. She said DNA in talking about things that we inherit from the women who have come before us. And I've always really been fascinated with this idea of spiritual DNA, wondering if we can inherit spiritual traits from our mothers and our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers in the same way that we might inherit eye color or stature or intelligence. And thinking about my grandmother specifically and some of the traits that they have. I have one grandmother on my mom's side who is the baby whisperer. And my mom has inherited this trait as well. And it's this ability to calm any crying baby with just a look and maybe just like a gentle touch. My grandmother does it. My mom does it. And I wonder too, you know, when I have my own children, if I'll have this ability to be the baby whisperer. I think that's a spiritual gift. My grandmother on my father's side is a very strong, committed woman. She's very committed to her relationships, and she's a very dedicated mother. She had 8 boys. They were Catholic.
And I too wonder about sort of that strong, strong sense of self and her place in her family and her place in the world. And I think that I've inherited some of that from her as well. So I love this idea of spiritual DNA. And I wanted to do a blog project that sort of celebrated this, celebrated my grandmothers and what they offer to the world spiritually. And it was also a way for me to sort of place myself. It was a way for me to locate myself within my own spiritual landscape, right? So when we start learning about our ancestors, learning about the women who came before us, we can maybe better get a sense of who we are and how we've developed the way we have and why we've made the choices we've made. And I thought it would also be really interesting because I have three grandmothers from three very different religious lines. I have my maternal grandmother who comes from Mormon pioneer stock. I have my paternal grandmother who is Catholic, very strong Catholic. And then my step-grandmother is Jewish. And so I thought what would be interesting was to create a blog where I explored those three lines, the Jewish, the Mormon, and the Catholic grandmothers and their spiritual experiences. So I decided to call my blog the Alderwood Triptych, and the symbolism behind that is that the Alderwood is a Celtic symbol of nurturing and of protection and giving. And so I thought, well, gosh, these women, how have they nurtured my spirituality? What have they given to me and my sense of self? And so I thought that would be a good symbol for the Alderwood. And then the triptych is, of course, a triptych is a work of art where you have three panels. So the triptych being the Mormon panel, the Jewish panel, and the Catholic panel. And I wanted just to read, this was the very first entry I had for the blog, and it explains a little bit better, I think, than I'm articulating right now, what the blog was about and the impetus behind it. A few weeks ago, I was listening to an interview with historian Claudia L. Bushman. For most of the interview, she discussed the history of women in the LDS Church and read some very cool excerpts from journals kept by early Mormon pioneers. At the end of the conversation, the interviewer asked Claudia what women in the LDS Church could do to better integrate women's voices into the larger church narrative. She said without a breath of hesitation, "Write! Write the stories of your grandmother, your mother, yourself. Write it down." I was completely inspired by her response and not a little drunk on the entire interview and decided to create the Alderwood Triptych. This project is part genealogical record, part social history, and part journal. I want this to be a place where I can develop and give honor to my grandmother's stories and the spiritual traditions with which they identified. Each month will begin with a theme, a religious or spiritual theme. The first Sunday of the month, I will write my feelings and experiences about the theme, and the subsequent Sundays will be used to explore that theme in relation to each of my grandmothers. So this was back in the fall. September's theme was foundation, so I took each Sunday of the month of September to introduce each grandmother and introduce myself. And at the very end, I say, I'll begin with an introduction of myself. I'm a triptych. My left panel reveals the ancestral ties and vigorous traditions of my Jewish grandmother. My right panel reveals the fierce devotional and saintly passions of my Catholic grandmother. And my core panel reveals the soft assurances and rigid ethics of my Mormon grandmother. Jewish, Catholic, Mormon, this is my Holy Trinity. So I thought, you know, what I might do is just to show you how the blog works, maybe read a couple of entries. So the month of September, I covered prayer, and then the next month, I covered prayer. So the first Sunday of the month, I talked about prayer, just my own interpretation of prayer, my own experiences with prayer, and then followed with the experiences of prayer with my other grandmothers. So let's see if I can go into October. Now, this blog has been on hold for quite a few months because I got wrapped up in work, but I'm really excited to get going on it because I think it's been a really fun, interesting project. Okay, so maybe I'll read. This was my sort of introduction to prayer. Prayer presents herself in countless forms. She's head bowed and knees bent, breath in and breath out. She is two happy arms swimming through the air and grasping at the trees. She is a call out to the universe and a whisper into the heart. Prayer is the foundational element of our spiritual lives, no matter where we fall in the religious spectrum.
and she is certainly no respecter of persons. I dress up in many of prayer's forms. I press my hands and face to the ground and imagine that my supplications reverberate through each layer of earth, crust, mantle, core, to reach the fiery center of God. As I wait with hands and face to the ground, God speaks from that smoldering spherical heart. The message travels back up through crust, mantle, core, and into skin, muscle, and bone to reach the fiery center of me. This is the journey of my revelation. So I'll begin with a sort of a self-reflection about prayer, and then the next Sunday I talked about prayer with my Jewish grandmother. And I like to include a work of art. I'm an art historian, so I like to include art with my blog entry. So this is an image of a woman of prayer, a beautiful image. I was doing some reading up on prayer in my handy Judaism book, and I've already learned some fascinating facts from our beloved author, Mr. David S. Ariel. For example, David tells me that there is a word in the Jewish faith, tefillah, which refers to the spontaneous outpouring of the human heart. If there's anyone who enjoys some spontaneous heart pouring, it's me. I love this idea that our heart is full of liquid desire, hope, yearning, seeking, and when it is full to the brim, our faithful yearning waterfalls into prayer. David also taught me that there are three main types of prayer in Jewish culture. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, so if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, forgive me. Hodeah, which is a thanksgiving prayer. Tehillah, which is praise. And Bakasha, which is request. Grandma Shore, which is my step-grandmother, took her family to her mother and father's house every Friday evening for the Sabbath meal. The oldest male child was responsible for saying the Hodeah prayer over the Sabbath meal, which incidentally was my stepfather, Jack. Jack went to Hebrew school where he memorized the standard prayers that he then repeated for the Sabbath meals and his bar mitzvah, among other places. He recalled to me a piece of the Friday evening prayer. We thank Adonai, who brings bread from the earth and wine from the vine. I love the simplicity of this repetition and the intention. To be grateful for the earth, the bread, and the wine is to be in tune with the very fundamentals of living, I think. So this is just getting started. I don't have very many entries. I think I've probably got about 6 entries in total, but I'm really excited to kind of expand on this whole idea of exploring the three lines of my genealogy. And the thing I think was really interesting and important, especially for maybe for women in my generation, is that I always had this sense of genealogy being very dry, right, and just filling in lots of lines and looking at the microfilm and getting nauseous, like as you do the switching. It just never appealed to me. And I thought, after listening to that interview with Claudia Bushman, I thought there are so many ways that we can honor our history. There are so many ways that we can honor the women in our lives and the people in our lives in general. And blogging and the internet and technology, I think, is a very new, relatively new and exciting way of doing this. So it's one more way, I think, of exploring our genealogy and doing that work that needs to be done. So thank you.
Okay. Well, I find it fascinating that two of my pioneer ancestors whose stories and lives are best known to the family are the same two for whom we have physical heirlooms. And you can see those sitting over there, and I'll show them as I talk in a minute. Is Mary Sorensen remembered for her exciting pioneer stories because her sampler hangs at my aunt's house and her wonderful stories get told upon seeing it? Or did Mary's experiences cause her descendants to preserve the sampler? And does seeing Elizabeth Fox's treasured green plate brought from England displayed on my grandmother's shelf remind us of Elizabeth's sacrifices? Or did the plate get saved to remember her story? And for those ancestral women for whom I have no physical evidence, how does that impact my relationship to them and to telling their story? As a de facto family historian and curator, examining these questions has helped me better understand and undertake my obligation to share these heirlooms and lives with others in a virtual world. So my second great-grandmother, Mary Sorensen, was a teenager when she and her family crossed the plains. She grew up in Denmark. They left in 1862, so she was about 12. And she had attended a dame sewing school in Denmark before she left, so she brought a sampler with her to work on the journey. As you can see, she did the alphabet, and the whole thing was originally red and blue. So the top thread was the Danish thread she had brought with her, and then the bottom part was the American thread that she had bought partway through the journey to finish. And after she finished the alphabet portion, she embroidered the initials of her younger half-siblings who died on the journey. So this sampler not only showcases her skill with the needle, but it was a memorial for her dead siblings. And I think it also symbolizes her feelings towards her heritage in a way she certainly didn't intend with the fading thread. But Mary was always proud to be a Dane. And even as an old woman, she loved to read about the Viking exploits. And she would tell her grandchildren, she'd square her shoulders. She was a tiny woman, but stand up tall with her blue eyes shining and say, "Always remember, we as Vikings and we don't cry." And so I think those Danish threads remain bright both in her life and in her sampler. Then my third great-grandmother, Elizabeth Fox, was a young mother in England who joined the church in 1851. After her conversion, her husband became abusive and eventually left the family, so she worked in a factory to save enough money to take her two children with her to America. Family tradition says that she threw her wedding ring overboard as she sailed. And back when she finally arrived here and settled, she did remarry and was really involved with early Relief Society efforts in Idaho. And she was always known as being a fine English lady with a beautiful flower garden and nice furniture and the flaming Christmas pudding that she would create. So she brought these two green plates with her across the plains, Majorca china plates. And they passed down to her daughter's daughter's daughter, who is my grandmother. And a century after its transatlantic voyage, one of the plates was broken. My rebellious uncle was a teenager in the 1960s, and his rock band practice got a little too rowdy in the kitchen, I guess. And it's actually this plate that's here. It's been glued back together. But in some ways, I think that break was prophetic. The family and religious ties also broke in my uncle's life. And I see the broken and the whole plate as indicative of Elizabeth's life. She had these two marriages, one broken and one not. And things that are passed down for many years can and do break, but they can also be put back together. And the brilliant green color of these plates also invites attention, as has her life. So I also have ancestors with no heirlooms, as we all do, and one of them, who really touched my heart a couple years ago, was my fourth great-grandmother, Rebecca Rogers. I had never seen a picture of her or anything she had owned, and without passing down artifacts, she had essentially been forgotten by the family. I came across an account of her life which fascinated me. She was a young servant girl. She got pregnant, eloped with the wealthy son of the employer, but then they were cut off from his family and had to make it on their own. And then she was widowed when she was pregnant with her seventh child. So as a single mother, she raised these kids in England, and they later learned of the gospel, and she sent them ahead to America as she could afford it gradually, and they were more grown up. So finally, at 65, she herself made the journey and crossed the plains, but frozen in Wyoming, she died only the day after arriving in Salt Lake. And, this tugged at my heartstrings, and I wanted to honor her in some way, so I knew she was buried in Salt Lake, so I went up to the Salt Lake City Cemetery with a bunch of flowers one day to put them on her grave. And when I got there, I discovered that she was buried in the pauper section and there was no headstone. So I organized a family effort to put up this headstone a couple years ago. And I felt like she'd become come to mean so much to me. And then I was really intrigued because my aunt came across this photo of her.
Do you want to turn the slideshow on so you can just push the arrows? Oh,
probably, but I've only got a couple more, so.
Okay.
All right. And this photo has been unknown in the family for decades, and it was labeled, but no one had ever displayed it or treasured it. And because of, I think, my efforts in resuscitating her, this photo has been found again, and I feel like it was almost a gift back from her to me. And as artifacts are physical, tangible items, they connect with one of those five love languages, the gift-giving. And that one's strong in my own personality. And sort of thinking about these stories and the artifacts and things last year, I wanted to find a way to share these ancestors with others in the virtual world and in some ways give them gifts themselves. I mean, it's impossible, but just the idea of a virtual gift. And so what I created is this birthday blog. And every day this year on someone's birthday, I spotlight them on my blog, which I'll click on in a minute here. But what I really wanted, I didn't want it to be the dry, dusty, Xerox genealogy paper in a file looking thing. And so I picked this party tree from my blog banner because I wanted it to look like these were real people who lived and loved and had parties and gifts and might have enjoyed celebrating their birthdays. And so last year I made a list of all the ancestors that I knew enough about to say something about, besides, you know, their name and date, and kind of calendared that out throughout the year so I could see this year how busy I was going to be. And I'm also doing my husband's side. So between the two of us, it's about 150 people. And some of them are a couple a day, and sometimes I have a dry spell of a week with no one. But it's really been an interesting way to think about these ancestors and their lives and share that with others. So as I spotlight them on their birthday, I feel like in some ways I'm resuscitating their memories for this new generation. And that's such a value of our digital age, is this ability to repackage things so that those boring stories or photos or things that are hidden or badly Xeroxed can be linked and clicked on. And I found, especially for my own children, this is a great way to connect, because they don't pull a book off the shelf to read about the ancestors, but they do read an email or something in their Google Reader. And I have been surprised but delighted that my daughter actually reads these and comments, and oh yes, there's the link. And she comes up with some of the best gift ideas. Thank you so much. So here you can see, I call it Family Tree Rings. It's familytreerings.org. And I kind of made it look like a party thing with the cupcake icons, because I just wanted it to look fun. And on the left sidebar going down, everyone who's already been featured has their name, and you can find them alphabetically. But for people who don't really know, relatives who don't really know their family history backwards and forwards, on the left here I have these pages where the birthday party planner lists out the whole year, so you can see the schedule of who's going to be featured which day. So, for example, here's the January group, and you can click on each of them because I've linked them in. Or you can also just go to the family tree page, and if you know which ancestor you're looking for, I'll show you the Welch one that I've been talking about with some of these people here. Let's see. You can go down, and I've just listed them by generations, and so this first group right here are my great-grandparents. And then we go down to the great-great-grandparents and further back. So here is Mary, for example, who did the sampler that I just showed you. And it has I usually start with a photo and a little intro, and then if people want to click on more, they can read the whole rest of it. But and then I do the bio and talk about their lives, and it goes on down, and so, see, my gift to her is I would get her a Viking hat. And I talked about the sugar cookies, her recipe that she liked. So I said, enjoy a sugar cookie for her today. And then the others, you know, had just added their own little gift ideas and comments at the bottom. So a couple other things I thought were helpful. On the top, some people have asked, you know, where can I find out more? And you know, at family reunion sort of things for other people actually care about some of these ancestors. And I had already written some books, Family History Pioneer kind of things, which are so wonderful how you can print on demand now and just email a link out. And so I put those links under party favors. And then some people also ask about the sources. And so I've done a page here for those who are interested in, you know, finding out more or getting the actual original documents I was basing things off of. So you can get an idea of the sources there. Look. So I've been pleased to have some distant cousins contact me just by Googling. They found me, and you know, in every instance, it's been a female, which I thought was interesting. But I have found that by sharing these things, you know, in every generation, there may only be one photo, or one gilt portrait, or one sampler plate, but online now, we can share all these virtually. And so my next project, I have this idea to do a virtual cedar chest blog where I am featuring each of these artifacts and talking about where they're located so everyone knows what's hiding in grandma's attic or the aunt's cupboard. And I think that would be a great way for descendants to share everything virtually when we can't all touch the exact plate or share it physically. And by giving everyone their day in the sun, I feel that I have in some way leveled ancestral inequality, You know, in every family, fame and artifacts and writings mean that some ancestors are more prominent. And when you're looking for that talk or that story for Trek, you go to Mary or Elizabeth because you know them and their artifacts. But by doing this sort of thing and featuring everyone on their birthday, no matter how famous or well-loved they were at the time, hopefully I have leveled this just a little bit, and now I think that Rebecca is as well-loved in our family as Mary and Elizabeth, and I hope for a similar effect for others I have been digging out of their figurative graves, so these women and their stories will live again and live on. Thanks.
Chris, in setting up, I just wanted to share my sort of material, part of my material history. And I knew I would be presenting today, and so I just took the opportunity to ask my mom yesterday in the car as we drove home from work why she sewed for my sister and me. She's always sewn for us. And she's made costumes, dresses, skirts, and now she makes quilts for us. And I'm actually wearing one of the skirts she made. And cute little buttons, green buttons on the side. And I hope one day she'll make my wedding dress, if that day ever comes. But she said that from my birth it was instinctual. She literally brought me home from the hospital, left me with my dad at my grandparents' house, and drove to the fabric store to buy material to make bumpers for my crib. And she said that she wanted to wrap me and my sister in beauty and love and protectiveness. And she has an early memory of her mother sewing for her, and it was a very comforting memory, but her mother made her a mustard-colored dress with a brown collar and some brown pockets. She also shared that one of her favorite fairy tales is of the girl who has to sew shirts out of nettles for her brothers who've been turned into swans to restore them to themselves, she says. And that story has always really intrigued me, too. And she says, there's something very elemental about clothing the people I love. It is part of what God did to prepare us to be in the world, clothing us. And this is an idea that was also reflected in Amy Hickman's essay about the temple aprons that she's inherited and how, she says, the first conscious act of, you know, human beings in this world was to sew and to cover themselves. So that is what I wanted to share. And I was thinking about four mothers, and the scripture from Alma 5:6 came to me, and, you know, I know among a lot of sort of feminist-minded people, restoring a feminine voice to the scriptures is very important, and I just wanted to read this because I thought it was so beautiful. We think of the captivity of our fathers, but what about the captivity of our mothers? And it reads, "Now behold, I say unto you, my sisters, you that belong to this church, have you sufficiently retained in remembrance the captivity of your mothers? Yea, and have you sufficiently retained in remembrance his mercy and long-suffering towards them? Behold, he changed their hearts. Yea, he awakened them out of a deep sleep, and they awoke unto God. Behold, they were in the midst of darkness. Nevertheless, their souls were illuminated by the light of the everlasting word. Yea, they were encircled about by the bands of death and the chains of hell, and everlasting destruction did await them. But their souls did expand, and they did sing redeeming love." And I think, you know, as Chrisanne was talking about spiritual DNA and the things we inherit from them, we've also inherited a religious legacy from them. And for many of these women, the LDS Church and the Gospel of Christ have been a significant part of them. And it's something that we can carry on and share with our families. And, you know, we can receive the same kind of liberation. It doesn't matter what time we live in. It doesn't matter, you know, where we live. As Anita was saying, it's sort of, you know, the gospel is a great leveler. And so I just want to say those things. And Chris is going to be talking more about religious artifacts and how women interacted with them in our history. And so, take it away.
I thought it'd be really great to just do my presentation in CASA. I have a nice slideshow and put it in a web album, but of course this university doesn't allow you to access.
Oh no.
So hopefully. Computer, 14-year-old person. My picture, not so much this side.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll play around with
okay, that. Well, I'll talk for a second and we'll see how it goes. So I was really excited to hear the comments after Colleen McDaniel's lecture on Wednesday night. And there was some discussion about gendered divisions of Mormon material culture and bread baking. And I was really hoping to discuss some of those things today. And as we've learned through this conference, things are much more than just things. Things are powerful, compelling living agents. They touch us, they scare us, they calm us, they protect us. And we can maybe really develop a better understanding of belief when we see it as emerging from and kind of enfolded within practices and things and feelings that shape us as individuals and communities over history. So unlike a lot of the panelists here, I don't have a legacy of inherited LDS objects, but instead I've created my own material connections to the Mormon past by bequeathing myself with a set of sacrament cups. Oh, we're getting there, so that you can kind of see what it looks like.
Yeah.
I just want to lift it up and shift
it. Really.
Oh,
wait, I think I can do that.
So I'll let you continue on with that. So I have this old glass sacrament cup and a metal sacrament cup, and I keep them in a shadow box on my piano. And when I first purchased them, I wanted them as a tactile reminder of my own personal baptismal covenants. But they've also really come to evoke connections that really viscerally connect me to my ward community and those and that sacramental meal that we share together, and also to Mormon history. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
you can
sorry.
Kind of say, no, it's good. That's good. So let's see if the next one works then. There you go. Well, you can kind of see that's the bottom of it. You can see the name of the person who made it, and it was made for the Deseret Sunday School. So objects themselves are extremely instructive, and when we want access to see how they're viewed and how they were used in the past, the entries of hundreds of Latter-day Saint diaries and reminiscences illustrate how ritual objects can be a primary form of evidence for understanding religion as a lived experience. Mormon history has generally been the study of texts, either theological or poetic or narratives of words and concepts. But when we join that with the study of objects, as well as the practices that put them to use, we can create a more comprehensive account of religion as a lived experience. So today I'd like to talk about some religious or sacred objects like consecrated oil, sacrament vessels, sacrament bread, and garments, and then kind of reconceptualize how women have interacted with them, and that sheds light on their religious experience. Before I go any further, I'd kind of like to kind of conceptualize my comments for you and explain the framework I'm working from. So a lot of scholars have remarked that women's ritualizing is different in that it kind of liberates itself from bonds of verticality. So in ways that, you know, a lot of structures are built up architecturally or we have a lot of hierarchies, women more work on a horizontal axis. And you can see that sometimes that, you know, women will put chairs in a circle as opposed to structuring people above each other. And female rituals often also spring from domestic tasks, and this can happen kind of self-consciously, or it can happen incrementally, where somebody's developing a ritual and they might not even realize they're fully developing it until it's formed. One of the most significant sources for women's ritualizing, both because of its accessibility and its neglected institutionalized religion, is the experience of women themselves. And female ritualizing really occurs in place and time. So it's not necessarily the sacred other, but it's rooted in the here and now, in everyday materials and in ordinary locations where women live and work. So when we expand our ideas about belief and ritual to include how women interacted with these types of objects outside of official ordinances, we can see that the boundaries of gender in relation to material religion maybe weren't always as clearly delineated as we think. So we think, oh, oil is a priesthood thing and women didn't interact with that, or some of these other aspects. And so finally, the other thing I just want to say is that historian Catherine Breckus has recently pointed out that historical agency can be located not only in how religious structures and communities were challenged, but how they were reproduced and how habitual and routinized activities brought meaning and stability to women's lives. So it really kind of comes out of this idea that in restoring women to history, we often see those outstanding, unusual actors and sometimes overlook kind of the everyday things that actually reproduce and move the church forward. So I'd like to start with consecrated oil, which is an object that women have used ritually and officially sanctioned ways pretty much through the history of the whole church. In many ways, consecrated or holy oil can be described as the connective fluid of early Mormon life, and it can be seen as a vehicle for the binding of a religious community. The use of oil reveals a web of social and familial networks, concepts of gender, the connection between saving and healing liturgies, and it also illustrates early Mormon ideas of charisma and power and salvation. Consecrated oil has occupied an important place in Mormon ritual and social practice since about 1834. It was an essential part of temple worship. It was used in priesthood blessings and anointing the sick and the dying, and in the initiation of women into motherhood. At times, it has been ingested as a healing cure and massaged into ailing body parts. And so when we look at how this religious object was used, both religiously and therapeutically, as well as the perceptions of the functions of it and how its properties have changed over time, historians can really see how ordinary Mormons created meaning out of these embodied forms of religious experience. So while oil did become a conduit for the expression of priestly power, it wasn't always exclusively bound to one gender. Women had open access to consecrated oil starting in the Kirtland period and used it frequently to administer healing blessings throughout the 19th and early 20th century. And you can find frequent examples of women anointing with oil in Nauvoo, winter quarters, on the Trail West, in Utah, in foreign missions, and really using it in both kind of sacred and mundane circumstances. It was part of temple ordinances. It was how they would heal the sick. They would give it to people who had a sore throat. It was used in all and any location. And from the earliest stages, church leadership lent support to women to use the oil. While in Nauvoo, Brigham Young said, "I want a wife that can take care of my children while I'm away, who can pray, lay on hands, anoint with oil, and baffle the enemy." Starting around 1880, women were also initiated into motherhood by washing and anointing during the final stages of their pregnancies. Such blessings really sacralized motherhood and created deeper kinship relationships among women who performed and received these rituals. Midwives sometimes anointed babies with oil at birth. At a Relief Society conference in the Logan Tabernacle, Zina Young said publicly, "I wish to speak of the great privilege given to us to wash and anoint the sick and the suffering of our sex. I would counsel everyone who expects to become a mother to have this ordinance administered by some good, faithful sisters." And while women were encouraged not to formalize such blessings, there's at least six examples of the text where people tried to write it down, which remain. And the wording of these blessings really highlights the role that oil played in the consecration of maternity, and specifically, like, specific body parts. So, you know, you would have your actual body parts consecrated for the purpose of birth, which would be really a very powerful experience for these women. One of the surviving blessing texts specifies that it is unnecessary to use as many words in the washing as in the anointing, as the washing is only preparatory to the anointing, thus underscoring the importance of the oil, both in a symbolic and a literal function. Confinement blessings, like all healing blessings, often reveal social and kinship networks, so you can see relationships between polygamous wives, aunts, cousins, friendships. It's quite interesting, and you will also sometimes see, you know, don't get so-and-so because I'm concerned about their worthiness, or please get so-and-so because, you know, they have this great gift. The end of life was also a time to affirm your role in the consecrated community. And so Caroline Barnes is an example of this great case of the death of anointing. And she goes to see the wife of Samuel Stevens, and she says, "I went to visit her, washed and anointed her from head to foot with Sister P's help. She seemed very anxious to live to receive her endowments in the temple, and we also felt very sorry that she could not. I, anointing her, inadvertently told her that it was for her burial. Notwithstanding my anxiety to have her live, but the words some way pressed themselves out of me." So, you know, you have these very biblical images being invoked, and this poor woman being anointed for her death. But once again, these physical embodied rituals that are centered around life cycle events. And so from birth to death, or from sore throats to the highest temple ordinances, interactions with consecrated oil really can tell us a lot about thoughts and actions and bodies and practices. So while a lot of people might think that LDS women stand on the periphery of our rituals, it's really clear that historically women had direct embodied experiences with these objects and were frequently the ones who produced and cared for them. Sacrament bread and sacrament vessels are a case in point, once again springing from these foundational moments of LDS history. Zebedee Coltrane paints a vivid picture of the centrality of bread to early Mormon worship. And he said, "The sacrament was also administered at times when Joseph appointed, after the ancient order, that is, warm bread to break easy was provided and broken into pieces as large as my fist. And each person had a glass of wine and sat and ate the bread and drank the wine. And Joseph said that that was the way that Jesus and his disciples partook of bread and wine." Early Mormon women in Kirtland, like Nancy Naomi Tracy, transformed their kitchens into sacred space. She recalls, "Blessings were poured out, solemn assemblies were called, endowments were given. The elders went from house to house, blessing the saints and administering the sacrament. Feasts were given, three families joined together and held one at our house. We baked a lot of bread." Throughout Mormon history, women have created sacramental meals for their community. These responsibilities were taken seriously and engaged in over long periods of time with great care. Historians and foodway scholars have examined the role of food in women's religious experiences and have argued compellingly that food practices have enabled women to exert power within their families and in their religious communities. So there's lots of examples. Joseph F. Smith's wife, Julina, wrote about baking the sacrament bread. There's a woman, Frances Ann Adams, she baked the sacrament bread in her ward for 25 years. Ruth Mace Waddell recalled, "The women in the ward took turns providing the bread for the sacrament. Mum would take special care when it was her turn. She would make sure that the final product was white in color and that the texture was even. She cut off the crust so it would look beautiful in the tray. Mum always made good bread, but for the sacrament, it had to be just right." Similarly, a daughter remembered Charity Kinder Savage's sacramental baking in southern Utah. "At that time, the bishopric took turns in furnishing the sacrament. When it was Father's turn, Mother had her own way in preparing it. She cut the crusts off the loaves of bread, then sliced it into half-inch strips. Preparing it this way made it easier for the priests to break it up evenly. She had crystal plates she kept for the sacrament only. She would put the bread on plates, cover it with a pretty white linen towel that she kept especially for that purpose. Father was always so proud to take it to church." So such accounts of special plates and cloths and attention to details of texture and preparation, they all underscore the shaping effect of repetition, the significance of human making and doing, the creation of ritual, and the idea that belief is more than a linguistic act. David Morgan, who is a great historian of visual material culture, he said, "Belief is not merely the symbolic act of representation, but the symbol as well as all that it evokes and draws on." So in addition to sacramental baking, women frequently prepared the sacrament table, as it did not appear on the list of priesthood duties until 1933. Metal sacrament trays needed to be polished, goblets. I think I have a picture now. So there's a picture of, this is actually an ad. Oh, we're tuning. Well, that's what I want to show you. So that is actually
just from the Museum of Church History. And so originally, their sacrament goblets and pitchers were used. So all of these things had to be cared for. There. And there's the picture. You can kind of see that's a picture in a magazine where, you could buy the sacrament trays. It's got 36 glasses, it says. So, women were responsible for these things for quite a while. White linen or lace tablecloths needed to be created, laundered, starched, and pressed. Traditionally, all the work of women. Kate Corliss of Salt Lake City, 4th Ward, took care of the sacrament table for a quarter of a century. She crocheted the cloth, polished the silver trays, baked and sliced the bread, and set the sacrament table. Young women were also able to have embodied experiences with sacramental objects. As late as 1943, the presiding bishopric publicized the example of young women in one ward who take care of washing and sterilizing the sacrament sets after each service. One girl recalled that during the 1930s, she said, the young girls of MIA filled the water cups in the kitchen and placed the bread on the trays. We then prepared the sacrament table with the cloth and trays on it. It was a wonderful privilege I shall always remember. And when paper cups replaced glass cups like you see in this tray, that was during the 1940s. Of course, all of these, the dishwashing ceased, and so did female involvement with sacrament vessels. Finally, another multi-layered example of women's interaction with sacred objects can be found in the rich example of LDS garments and temple clothing. And I'm really kind of at the preliminary stages of research in regards to these religious objects, but because garments are so ubiquitous in the experience of active believing Latter-day Saints, I don't want to skip them over. And I think, Liz, your idea about how you want to clothe your daughter shows the idea of the powerful nature of clothing. Clothing is intimately intertwined with the spiritual and the social. It reveals gender, social, and religious identity, and it's often a central item in life cycle rituals. So you can see those baby blessing gowns, our temple clothing, wedding dresses, and, of course, LDS burial traditions. And clothing is all an important part of that, including the endowment. Cloth and clothing play an important role in embodied belief practices. This belief is expanded by ritual performance, but also in the work that creates them. And I think we've talked about that a lot today. Thus, women had an important experience in the initiatory rituals with garments and temple robes, but also in the design, construction, and manufacturing of religious clothing. And that's kind of what I want to focus on today. The manufacturing and use of cloth and knits shows how women invest cloth and clothing with their beliefs. So each time that a woman would make and wear sacred garments, as well as engage in the religious rites that involve them, their beliefs and values are regenerated as well as internalized and embodied. Women played an essential role in the creation of garments from their very inception. A variety of sources allude to different original seamstresses, whether it be Emma Smith or Eliza R. Snow or Elizabeth Warren Allred. Either way, no matter who that is, it would seem that it's undeniable that Joseph sought out women to assist him in making a tangible garment. William Clayton records that Elizabeth Durfee made his garments while Hosea Stout's wife made his. Garments were cut and sewed in the sacred space of the Nauvoo Temple until the process became so unwieldy that Brigham Young had to select houses where the work could be done. Women remained the primary producers of garments in the domestic sphere, and then they moved into textile factory work, which I've got a picture of. There. You can't really see it. There's women in that picture, I swear. When the production of garments shifted into knitting mills, women were the large bulk of the workforce, and I suspect probably today women are intimately involved in the process. So clearly then, Mormon temple clothing played and continues to play an important role in transforming women's religious identities, and is an aspect of Mormon material culture that really deserves a deeper study. So in conclusion, I'd like to make a few remarks from our vantage point in the 21st century. It would be very easy for me sometimes to dismiss or to be uncomfortable with the work of baking and sewing and washing dishes, as we often can see these as these kind of menial tasks, particularly compared to the public perceptions of other rituals.
However, I suspect that if scholars are only going to study or place value upon interactions with sacred objects that happen within institutional or liturgical settings, we're going to miss many of the other ways that belief is embodied and practiced. Women anointed their sisters' bodies in temple ordinances and healing rituals. They administered oil orally to a sick child and engaged in the invisible work of creating, cooking, and caring for sacred and religious objects. Discerning the life of belief can be found in the stories of things, in bodies and spaces and practices, and I suspect can be a rich field of study for both historians and other scholars of material culture.
Thank you so much, everyone. Those were wonderful. Chrisanne is going to close with the poem Invocation Benediction by Joanna Brooks, which is a beautiful poem and sort of ties together the themes that we've been talking about. And then we will open it up for questions.
Father, Mother, help me piece together the contradictions of my life. White cotton, red satin, brown polka dot, torn Sunday dress, Navajo rug, frayed baby blanket. Make me insistent on every lonely shred, willing to sacrifice no one. Where there is no pattern, God, give me courage to organize a fearsome beauty. Where there is unraveling, let me draw broad blanket, stitches of sturdy blue yarn. Mother, Father, give me vision. Give me strength to work hours past my daughter's bedtime. Give me an incandescent all-night garage with a quorum of thimble-thumbed grandmothers sitting on borrowed folding chairs. We will gather all the lost scraps and stitch them together. A quilt big enough to warm all our generations, all the lost, found, rich, poor, good, bad, in, out, old, new, country, city, dusty, shiny ones. A quilt big enough to cover all the alfalfa fields in the Great Basin. Bigger. We are piecing together a quilt with no edges. God, make me brave enough to love my people. How wonderful it is to have a people to love.
All right, does anyone have any thoughts? Yes.
First of all, thank you all very much. This has been really wonderful. I have a question about the oil and the anointing. It's very easy for us to get olive oil now. How did people in the 19th century get olive oil? Or was, you know, it's not.
Well, it would seem it was brought from the East, like in that quote from Brigham Young, actually. It's just right after Christmas, and he's saying, you know what? We're going to shut down the temple because we can't do anything. We've run out of oil. So, you know, and then he gets kind of mad. You can almost hear him. He's like, you know, and we're not going to have all these people in here cutting their garments out. You're going to go away. So they would bring the oil with them, and it was certainly part of, say, the cotton missions. They were growing olives to try to produce their own, and later from California.
Go for it.
Well, this is a comment related to the issue of garments and temple clothing. Just a memory that I have that seems relevant. I think I was listening to a podcast, I want to say Mormon Stories, but who can say for sure, and it was a man talking about his own memory of receiving his endowment, and this was right when they had changed the garment from one piece to at least the two-piece option, if I remember right. And he said that the temple worker had been so upset about the change that in cutting his garments in the temple as part of the ceremony, he had actually drawn blood for this young man, you know, been a little too vigorous about it. But the thing that was interesting to me is that he, you know, he sort of mentioned just as an afterthought, and that, of course, then he took the garments home and his mother sewed up the markings. And so that seems like it would have been happening much more recently, maybe in, you know, the greater Salt Lake area. And that just seems very telling. I don't know. I just thought I would bring it up because it seems like another way that women could have been intimately involved in the process of all of this.
Are you going to question? In the back?
I was in college in 1958 and through 62 at Utah State. I had a classmate, a young woman, who I swear told us after the summer vacation the next year that she had been working in a factory that made LDS garments to make sumi, and that it also made nuns. Have you ever heard of that? And in fact, that I believe nuns were involved in the manufacture. I was stunned at the time, and I really didn't have anyone else to ask. It was often good nuns.
I don't know about that specifically, but I do know that there were knitting mills in Utah that some were owned by the church and some weren't, but a lot of them did produce the textiles and the garments, because the garments, of course, weren't marked before you went to the temple at the time, right? Mm-hmm. So they were, they weren't the same as today where they're invested with those marks. So it could have been an LDS owned or maybe not. I'm not sure if we've done that in the past.
Rosalind.
It's almost sort of a philosophical question. So in Western modernity, we've come to separate subjects from objects, subjects being persons who are sentient and conscious and objects that are not, subjects being imbued with rights and dignity and power and agency, and objects not. Now that's only kind of imperfectly captured in our own Mormon tradition. At the beginning, you know, we see seer stones and we see kind of traces of this sort of magical worldview where objects themselves have a kind of power, but you know, that really has been phased out in modern Mormonism. So sometimes, of course, objects can come to acquire a certain dignity and aura, either sacramentally, as you're talking about sacred oil, the garments, you know, they're invested with divine meaning and power. Sometimes sort of socially, you see what Anita has up here, because they belonged to sort of the original owner, the dignity of their personhood is transferred onto the object itself. So you're, you know, horrified to go cut up Mary's beautiful crosses because of who she was, right? But is there a way to think about objects separated from, you know, either sacramental divine power or personal power? Is there a way to think about objects themselves having a kind of inherent dignity? And I've been thinking about this because, like many women, I love to look at interior design and craft blogs, and there's kind of been this thing recently where people get books and they cut up books, or they deform or deface books in some way to make it into something else. Or you'll see a lot of people painting pianos, right? They'll take a piano and they'll paint it. Well, this horrifies me, right? I find this shocking and so offensive. And in trying to like figure out why I have this really strong reaction to it, it's because I guess I invest books and pianos with a sort of inherent dignity of the object. But I may be completely wrong about that. I may be totally wrong. These are just pianos, just books. You know, they're not people or beings. So what do you think? Is there a sort of inherent dignity to objecthood in the same way that there is to subjecthood, or is it, or is it not? And is my intuitive response all wrong?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, go for it.
As someone who talks to objects frequently, and you know, and feels like maybe I should give my objects a fair chance. I remember growing up and like feeling bad for certain pairs of shoes that didn't get worn as much as other pairs of shoes, and wondering if that hurt their feelings. You know, but I think that's really interesting. And also speaking as an art historian, I can see both sides of it. I can see, for example, we have a work of art and it's an object and there it is. And changing it or modifying it in any way could be horrifying in the same way that you look at somebody changing or modifying a book. But then with that said, I also think about objects as being a conversation that doesn't ever stop. And sure, somebody wrote this book and they created this book and here it is as a book, an object, but that doesn't necessarily mean that its life as an object ends there. That perhaps in the manipulation of it, in cutting it up and designing it and decorating it, it is maybe a rebirth for that object, or it's just one more phase of that object's life. Does that make sense? So maybe it's not as horrifying as it needs to be.
Like the china for the Kirtland Temple.
That's a great example. Yeah, repurposing. Mm-hmm. I think can extend the life of an object in a different way, with a different voice.
I think that is more, for me, it's more if it's been mass-produced versus, homemade. You know, you feel like you can mess with stuff that are mass-produced more than something that someone made themselves. You know, they made the book cover. I mean, they did the whole thing. To me, that would be totally sacrilegious to do something.
Yeah, there's such a subjective nature to it, because, for instance, like, I would never paint a piano, but I would paint a dresser. Well, and whether or not I'm observing the integrity of the dresser, but also there's, just the change over time. Like, I'm thinking in terms of oil, it's really interesting that, so many 19th century men and women refer to oil as holy oil. And you see a shift over time as we move into the 20th century that it's consecrated oil, which it really is quite revealing about the object itself, right? It's not necessarily the oil that has inherent holy properties, but it's more a ritual object. It's not so much, it's the process and the ritual as opposed to the oil itself, and that's also perhaps, why we don't drink it anymore, too.
Yes, are these thoughts related to this question?
I was thinking that the item perhaps derives its value from the subject or the connection to the subject.
Right, which is
as much as if it could be a mass-produced item, but if the context that I see it or I live with it, it gives it a totally different value. Someone just sees it sitting on the shelf. So I think my experience with the object puts the value in.
So I think what everybody is saying is that no, there is no inherent dignity to the object, but we, as subjects, we transfer that onto the object in one way or another through art or through personal living.
I think it might depend upon the object.
As a librarian, I would say books have
value.
Yeah, I think...
Well, books previously owned by Joseph Smith, for example, you get $1,000 for a 50-cent book that belongs to Joseph Smith. So there's some knowledge in the ownership transferring the value. And there's also the deal about flags that you have to treat properly because they're somewhat sacred in themselves. And also, did you ever hear the NPR thing about the little Jewish boy whose name was the same as God's, I guess, or the relative? And he's always priest every time his mother wrote his name on his lunch sack. His teacher said the name of God and took away and punished him. And they had to put in a closet and saved to be sacredly disposed of. Those are all beliefs that...
I remember when I first came to this country, I was working in a factory, and one of my co-workers, also an immigrant, had gone to a thrift store and ended up with a white shirt. What he saw as a white shirt turned out it was a U.S. garment. And he was wearing that during a regular day at the factory. When the factory owner came, he was LDS and saw that. Became very agitated and pulled him into the office and said, take that shirt off and give it to me and I will give you an element. And we never understood what that was all about. Now I see it differently. For that person, it had value where the context was lost.
I mean, I would maybe push back a little bit on the idea that these objects don't have any kind of subjective value in and of themselves, because if you look at a book, it's made from a tree. And I think, maybe this is based on my own sort of personal mythology, but, you know, just the idea that, you know, the literal object is also the metaphor, you know, that, like, without the tree, you wouldn't have, you know, the important sense of, like, the seed and the growth and, you know, so they're both dependent on each other, I guess. So that would give those, some of those objects, like, inherent value, like holy materials. They are holy because God has given them to us to use and things like that. But two more comments and then I think we're out of time. Yeah, go ahead.
Just kind of on that same note, like a way to push, you know, or highlight the other side, thinking that maybe these objects do have intrinsic value and everything. I remember a seminary teacher of mine in ninth grade talking one day about how the elements and these inanimate objects are beloved by God because of their perfect obedience to what they are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't know how widespread that is, but it just is a memory that I have thinking, yeah, I guess the trees and the dirt, all they do exactly what God wants them to do all the time.
Right. So. And on an atomic level, you know, how does the organization of these things work, you know, and how are they conforming to that order that allows them to exist in that structure that we see, I guess. But yeah, that's cool. Okay, yeah.
Oh, just really fast. It was on the topic of spiritual DNA. I just like that idea. I've been thinking a lot about that lately since I've been reading my great-great-grandmother's journal. And I'm just convinced there's got to be, like, spiritual DNA. Like, I have proof. there just has to be. It's a very interesting concept to me, and how that would, you know, how objects can kind of remind. I mean, when you don't have a journal, maybe you're you know, prone to subjectively react to an object in the same way as your ancestors did, or something. You know, when you don't have, like, a journal saying, you know, how they've reacted to objects or the objects in their life. I'm wondering if, you know, the way we might, maybe that's why I like brooches and lockets, you know, so much. Mothers all had them, and they may not be even the same one, but if I see one that looks like it, I have a response to that. But I just like the idea of being able to. Right, that's why I like this. I've never been a blogger, but I like this whole idea of writing down what you think. I never really realized the value in it until I started reading her journal.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all for coming, and don't let the discussion stop here. Continue.